Welcome to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman, and I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and the art of healing. Physician Dr. Abram Hoffer, pioneer of orthomolecular medicine, has been using nutrients as treatments for mental disorders since the 1950s, still practicing in his 80s. He says, and I quote, "No one ever suffered from a deficiency of psychiatric medications," close quote. Instead of putting a Band-Aid over a check engine light, using nutrient therapy to support and reverse addiction, depression, and behavioral problems has been thoroughly researched and proven to work more efficiently than pharmaceuticals. This didn't, however, impress the Office of Professional Medical Conduct of New York State when they brought physician Dr. Charles Gant, MD, PhD, before them on charges of gross negligence for using nutrient supplements to treat addictions and attention deficit disorder, I might add, successfully. In the end, the panel found that Dr. Gant had done no harm to his patients and agreed that he should not lose his license. So, when you wonder why more doctors don't practice alternative natural medicine, wonder no more. I'm joined today by Dr. Charles Gant. His books are End Your Addiction Now and ADD and ADHD Complementary Medical Solutions, and we'll be discussing the treatment of addiction. This is, of course, during our winter fun drive, even though the sun is out and spring is beginning to show itself in the air. I'm going to be looking for you to show your love and affection for KPFA and all of us who volunteer to bring you these shows by joining us during this hour. If you join at the $75 level, I can offer you a free thank you gift of End Your Addiction Now, Charles Gant's book. But I also have other thank you gifts, most notably a CD for Women's Day called Wars Against Women, Women Against War, speeches from this World Social Forum. And this is featuring Adirondi, I'm not ever sure I'm saying this name right, but I've heard it said right,
Arundhati.
You know, I just couldn't do it. I'm looking at it, and I couldn't say it right. Adirondi Roy, who has used her notoriety from her book, The God of Small Things, to raise issues against anti-globalization, and she talks a lot about the effects of class. She's a very important activist, and we can offer her CD, or the CD with her on it, at the $60 level. So either way, you're kind of in, and this hour, the numbers, as always, are 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. But let's get into our interview. Thank you, Sally, for making my mouth work. Let's get into our interview with Dr. Charles Gant, and let me just introduce him. Dr. Charles Gant, I might add also, who is a PhD and an MD, received his Bachelor's of Science in Chemistry and then his medical degree from the University of Virginia Medical School. His PhD in psychology is from Columbia Pacific University, and he's been a psychiatric consultant at several hospitals and clinics in the central New York area. Dr. Gant pioneered many of the nutritional treatments for addictions as medical director at Tule Hill Drug and Alcohol Rehabilitation Center and as medical consultant at Syracuse Behavioral Healthcare and as a private practitioner. He has devised nutritional and neuronutrient treatments for nicotine, alcohol, and drug abuse problems. And these protocols are currently being duplicated around the country and promise to improve treatment outcomes several-fold over current recovery rates. We're very honored to have you back on the air, Dr. Gant.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me again.
I was so pleased to find out that you have persevered through these hardships, and I would actually like to start the interview by asking you what exactly happened to you, because I think it's a very important story.
All alternative, complementary alternative medicine practitioners are, of course, a threat because to the conventional paradigm, because that paradigm or the incentives for conventional care depend on people staying sick and modifying those symptoms with drugs. So when people get well, of course, they don't come back for the visits and they don't buy the drugs and possibly not the insurance plans either. And So I didn't know that going in, of course. I was just happily using these wonderful technologies to bring health and joy to people's lives, and they were working so well, and it never occurred to me that I would be a... I had committed some kind of sedition against the establishment. But anyway, I've learned a lot. As long as I don't get into the victim story and feel sorry for myself or feel like I've been taken advantage of and face each day as a new day and persevere, then things have come out pretty well, actually.
One of the things that's really interesting in reading about what happened to you is that they brought you up in front of this board of professional medical conduct in New York State, which has become, New York State's become one of the most conservative states in terms of harassing alternative health practitioners. You are, in fact, in very good company because a very eminent, very popular integrative physicians have been brought up, not only in front of this board, but others. But they brought you up there, and you came prepared with case studies and all of the research, all of the, sort of peer-reviewed research projects that had been done that proved your protocol, and they told you that they were not interested in the science.
Well, yeah, not in that. In New York State, we have a law that says that basically, that if whatever you do works, then you can't prosecute a doctor on that basis. And so there was an attempt to try to get around our ability to present that all the patients that I was being charged with all had gotten well. And there was a major fight to try to keep that information out of the hearings. So here you have a health department dedicated to the mission of providing health and wellness to its citizens, trying to keep out evidence that people were getting well with this kind of treatment that was being done. It was really like a Fellini movie. It was almost comical if you don't consider the deadly implications behind it. But it was it got to be funny after a while, really.
Sounds more like Monty Python.
Yeah.
Let's take her into the fetus frightening room, where we have a machine that does nothing but go bing. So am I right in understanding that initially they backed down and you were reinstated, but that you, in fact, kind of decided to retire for a while because they were preparing to go after you again?
I was in no hurry to get my license back. Because basically you surrender your due process and civil liberties when you accept a license.
And isn't that the truth?
And so I'm not, if without a license I can...
You can say anything as
I
long
can
as
say
people...
say what I want.
Yeah, as long as people understand. Yeah,
I can actually heal people. People call me up and say, what I do is so-and-so, and I can tell them, and it's okay to do that. Nobody can say anything that I can't say that to them.
Right, this is why I don't have a license. It's true. All right, but then you decided that you better get back into the business of being a physician, am I right?
Well, I just for economic reasons, I think it's better to... I mean, if I have a license, then it increases my options at this point for what I do next, and I'm sort of at a crossroads and not sure exactly how I'm going to proceed, but having the license is probably better than not having a license, but not much better. It doesn't really offer that many more advantages.
Am I also right that all publicity is not good? You know, that old thing they say,
you can't win in the medical game,
yeah.
Right? Because it looks like anything that you do to protest only brings it up in the public eye more, and people have this suspicion that and a lot of people believe that their government is infallible, can't make mistakes, and therefore you must have done something wrong if this is happening. And it couldn't possibly be that this pretty much totalitarian system that we have called the healthcare system has dreadful political implications for both the practitioners and for the rights of consumers to get the kind of health care that they want.
And it's getting worse, you know.
Much worse.
We're faced with some, I'm going to have to do a show on this, but we're faced with some pending possible restrictions again on supplements.
Yes.
This losing access to ephedra, not that I think ephedra is such a fantastic product, but used carefully in the right combination with other herbs, it's probably appropriate for things like asthma and used in very small amounts. But you know, it gets abused, and we forget about all the drugs that are killing people, all the prescription drugs that are killing people, and ephedra is like, oh, 155 people got sick, where, you know, billions of people have died from prescription. Anyway, let's not go there. As long as I did go there, why don't you explain why not treating the underlying cause isn't even the most sinister thing about psychiatric drugs? You know, that they don't take care of like I said, nobody suffered from a lack of psychiatric medication. But that isn't even the worst thing about using psychiatric drugs. Why don't you tell us some of the reasons they are so sinister?
Well, what we've done is we've had a model for treating disease that came out of the germ theory, and countless people benefited from antibiotics, which are toxins, which are more toxic to germs than they are to people, and so a lot of lives were saved, and particularly in the last century. And there were also drugs that were designed to kill cancer cells that are very effective for some cancers, and that success led us to believe that there must be a toxin for any kind of problem, whether it's having some depression or anxiety, or whether you're going bald or can't get it up, or blood pressure is up a little bit, or have a little stomach distress. It doesn't matter. There's a chemical to put to snow it away. And it's kind of like you have this very good tool, antibiotics. So it would be like having a hammer, which is very good for pounding nails. And since it's so good for pounding nails, let's take the hammer now and start sawing boards and drilling holes with it. And it's a totally inappropriate tool for the task that's at hand. So treating brain chemistry imbalances with drugs, which only creates greater brain chemistry imbalances, even if the symptoms are temporarily improved, is completely the the wrong tool to use, unless there are some acute conditions that you are forced to do that, like if a person is danger to self or others. So I really have no problems with drug therapies. It's just that they're the treatment of last resort, should be the treatment of last resort, not the treatment of first resort. The treatment of first resort is to get to the underlying biochemical imbalances that are causing the symptoms, testing the person thoroughly if you can, or making your best assessment based on the clinical appearance, and then providing the proper nutrition and detoxification, the getting out the brain toxins, to allow those symptoms then to lessen or to go away completely.
What about the fact that some psychiatric medications can actually cause life-threatening withdrawal symptoms?
Oh, well, that's been known for a long time. Alcohol is the the most classical one with DTs, but generally, all the sedative class of drugs, the benzodiazepines, are much worse than alcohol and can cause life-threatening seizures called status epilepticus, or other kinds of problems that are life-threatening. And when drugs are mixed with alcohol, particularly the sedatives, then you get very bizarre kinds of problems, and also greatly increased suicidality. Half the suicides that are completed in this country are completed with psychiatric meds. So you get just strange and bizarre reactions from the combinations of drugs.
Well, and also we have people who are put on antipsychotics, for instance, and end up gaining 50-75 pounds and then become diabetic.
The side effects are unbelievable. See, the whole idea that it's just a bizarre thing. It's just that if a person has a brain toxicity that is causing symptoms, suppose they have lead poisoning, which is not that uncommon, people, particularly in children. or if a person has a toxicity from an abuse of alcohol or cocaine or something, or they have a toxicity from a gastrointestinal problem where the germs in the gut are making toxins that affects the brain. So here we have a brain toxicity problem, and then we're going to treat that with a brain toxin.
Right.
And that's it's ridiculous that it's hard to even imagine that it continues to be done, but somehow the medical profession and consumers in general just haven't woken up to it yet.
Well, they're not educated. They don't know that these are brain toxins. They think
right.
that they're being given something which is going to correct an
right.
imbalance in their brain. Now, it's also very important to say also, I think, that I'm seeing people now who are not only on one, but they're on two different psychiatric medications.
Oh, more than that. They get them 4 and 5 and 6. Frequently we see this. And see, the idea is if you had a germ in you that was making toxins and making you sick, the idea of taking a toxin to kill the germ is a very legitimate strategy. Because you kill the germ, then the germ's not making toxins, and you're not sick anymore. And same with cancer cells. But it just doesn't work very well for these other kinds of problems, because there's nothing to kill. There's no germ there. There's no cancer cell there that you need to kill with a chemical. And we wind up just killing people.
Yes.
Because these
yes.
are toxins, and they have injurious effects on the brain and body, and they. And what happens is a lot of people get hurt.
Yes, and I see that as well. You are listening to an interview with Dr. Charles Gant, who is an MD and a PhD, and we are discussing information that's in his book, End Your Addiction Now, which we will give to you at the $75 pledge level if you call us at 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732, and I will give you some more time to do that as we get into the interview a bit. So one of the things that we've already started to talk about is how people get into trouble, and what you're saying is that one of the primary reasons that people get into trouble is that they are exposed to what I like to call no-see-ums. No-see-ums, environmental toxins.
Oh, yes.
Metal toxicity, retroviruses, but a lot of stuff from the environment. Some people we're learning now have not been properly diagnosed and have Lyme disease.
Yes.
But then we also have people who have been exposed pretty readily. This is pretty common, to stress and trauma, and are self-medicating themselves with food and drugs. And that all of that stress that we just described, whether it's trauma, toxins, metals, self-medication, and nutrient deficiencies, end up causing neurotransmitter desensitization. So why don't you explain to us how
Sure.
we make happy chemicals?
Well, we have built into us stress hormones in the brain. They're called neurotransmitters, but they're like all the hormones around the body, just the neurotransmitters travel very short distances from one brain cell to another, whereas other hormones like cortisol from the adrenal gland can travel all around the body long distances. So we have these stress hormones which have various roles, but the two most important ones for this kind of discussion, the two most important ones are that they modify pain and stress so that we can cope. We used to think that coping was a psychological phenomenon, but now we know that coping is really the having enough of these stress hormones available so that it modifies the pain and stress that we have to deal with in life. And equally important is that these neurotransmitters and these stress hormones in our body enhance joy and pleasure for bonding, so that the ability to be close and be intimate and to enjoy the just have joy in life depends on having this good chemistry too. So naturally, if there is an artificial agent around that can mimic or short circuit those stress hormones, it would be very attractive, because it would immediately provide relief of pain and stress or enhance joy and pleasure. The problem is, though, that the body chemistry, the brain chemistry, adapts to the presence of an artificial agent, whether it's a prescribed medication, alcohol, marijuana, illicit drug, over-the-counter, doesn't matter.
Sugar.
Yes, sure, sugar. The brain and body, the chemistry, will adapt to the presence of that artificial agent and stop making its natural stress reliever, its natural joy-enhancing hormones because of the presence of this artificial stuff. So then the person starts noticing that they can't feel normal even unless they have the artificial chemical and they're hooked. And then they get into these spirals of addiction that, like you say, can come from many different angles and involve many different aspects.
Well, and one of the things we're talking about, too, is not only does sort of just stress and stress hormones cause some disruption, you know, when people start self-medicating with exogenous happy chemicals, but they also can, if the stress and the trauma and the toxins are a chronic problem, then it also interferes with just the ability of the body to absorb the nutrients it needs. Like you were saying, if the gut is traumatized in some way,
yes,
which can be a side effect of either a toxic exposure or a metal exposure or, gosh, even stress, and
yes,
then the person's not absorbing these raw materials.
And most people think that when they have gastrointestinal disorders, like irritable bowel or heartburn and different kinds of problems, they think that it's caused by stress, but actually it's the other way around. It's because of that gastrointestinal problem that a person can't absorb the precursors, the amino acids, the vitamins and minerals necessary to make the stress hormones to help them cope and to feel joy. So it's really the intestinal problem causing the brain problem, not the other way around.
Okay, so it would make sense, I think. I mean, there's a couple different ways to proceed here. One is to take on each one of these addictions and talk about how they interfere. But my impulse is, instead of doing that first, to talk about the main building blocks of these neurotransmitters, these amino acids that work so well when they're reintroduced at the levels that start to give you the raw materials to make your own pharmacy work.
Well, what we did in the book, in Your Addiction Now, is provided simple questionnaires that people can score themselves on to determine if they're a serotonin-deficient person, a dopamine-deficient, GABA, endorphins, if they're missing the natural morphine-type stress hormones. So you can score yourself and find out more or less which one you're deficient in. And then I provided the protocols where you can go out and buy the amino acids and the vitamins and the minerals to quickly reestablish that neurotransmitter. And if it's fairly uncomplicated, that is, a person doesn't have other kinds of interfering major problems, two or three, maybe three out of four people notice immediately, mm-hmm, that their mood is improved within hours or a day, that they feel more alertness, less mood swings, they're more concentrated, less irritability, and sleep better. They notice something's different. We call that the quick start, because the idea is to grab the person's attention right away and say, look, this is not a drug. This is a natural substance that you eat every day in your food, and look at the impact it can have on you. And once that happens, the person begins to have some faith that the natural wisdom of their own chemistry really can heal and really can, we're designed to feel good most of the time,
yeah,
and to be able to handle stress.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know that. They think that it can only happen with the help of some kind of a chemical crutch.
Well, it's interesting. I remember interviewing Antonio Damasio. His book is called Listening to Spinoza, and he talks about Spinozian psychology and the fact that it proves that the body and the mind are one. And one of the ways that he explains Spinoza this is that the mind tends to map the body and see how it's doing, and if it's doing okay, then the mood is kind of established from that. And what Spinoza says is that every living organism is just striving to be well and happy.
Yes.
That's our birthright, and we forget, yes, that's our birthright.
And in fact, symptoms when symptoms exist, the symptom itself is an adaptive expression of an attempt of the body to get well. If I'm just getting over the flu, so I cough every now and then, coughing gets the toxins out of the lungs, is clearing the last remnants of the stuff that's in my lungs. And so that symptom actually is a movement towards healing that happens.
Yes. Yeah. So the main amino acids that we're talking about are going to be what?
For people who are stimulant abusers, cocaine, Ritalin, trying to get off of Ritalin for ADD, and caffeine, they're bored and depressed a lot of the time,
speed
very low
breaks.
Energy.
Yeah.
Then tyrosine is the amino acid that for them.
And phenylalanine.
And phenylalanine. But phenylalanine can go off and do other things, so we try to use tyrosine because it's more of a direct, it's the closer to getting to dopamine and the noradrenaline where we want to direct it to replenish those stress hormones.
Yeah, I guess the only issue here would be that if someone has actually been diagnosed with a thyroid disease and they're trying to keep their thyroid under control in a suppressant way, then you probably want to stay away from tyrosine. That would be the
Yeah, it's hard to say. I've never seen it be a problem because when you use a natural substance, the body just knows how to use it appropriately. And so in general, tyrosine is very good for thyroid problems because it provides the precursor for thyronine, which is the thyroid hormone. But conceivably, if someone was hyperthyroid, it's possible, I guess.
Well, I would think. I would think. My observation, just in working with people from time to time who have Hashimoto's and are trying to be on take enough thyroid hormone so their own thyroid quiets down. You don't want to. Anyway, but let's move on. Let's not get bogged down. We should probably take a brief musical break and give people a chance to get copies of your book. When we come back, what we'll do is talk more about the specific amino acids. We just said tyrosine, but we've got a whole bunch of other ones up our sleeve.
Great.
So we're going to take maybe a minute break here. You are listening to Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with physician Dr. Charles Gant, Ph.D., M.D., and we are talking about his book, End Your Addiction Now, which we are offering at the $75 level if you call us at 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732, and we will give it to you as a thank you gift. I'm going to shut up for a minute and give you a chance to call the numbers again, 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732. We'll be back to our interview in just a moment. I just want to remind people that it's a good idea to pledge during this little mini break now because the lines tend to get jammed once we start pledging in earnest. Again, the book is End Your Addiction Now by Charles Gant, but I also have a Women's International Day special, a CD, Wars Against Women, and this includes a speech by, Adiranda, I'm not going to say her name right, it's amazing. Right. Anyway, she's the Indian woman who has spoken out against anti-globalization, and she's the author of The God of Small Things. Her CD, that CD, which is also available during this hour at 510-848-5732 or 1-800-439-5732, that's available at the $60 level. Remember also that we'll accept any contributions during these pledge drives if you already are a member, but you might want to get a copy of End Your Addiction Now as a it's a little counterintuitive, but as a Valentine's Day gift for somebody who you don't feel you can talk to about these problems. Anyway, it sounds like we've run out of music, so why don't we go back to our interview with Dr. Charles Gant. Are you still there with us?
I hear you. I had to cough a little bit.
I hear you. Yeah, I hear you clearing your lungs. I'm sorry that you had the flu. A lot of people were ill this winter and still.
You
what's the problem that you've seen with phenylalanine? Because some people are using phenylalanine in a therapeutic way.
Well, yes, it is. It is helpful. And D-phenylalanine,
painkiller.
There's a D and an L form. The D-phenylalanine is one of, or maybe the most important one, for people who have opioid abuse.
Oh.
With codeine or heroin or methadone, because what it does is it limits the effect of an enzyme which breaks down your natural opioids so that there's more of your natural opioids around to help you.
That's interesting. And I know the DL version is also a very good painkiller.
Yeah, the L-phenylalanine is made into L-tyrosine, and it's helpful, certainly, but the closer you get to the actual neurotransmitter you're trying to help, then the much more potent the effect becomes. So L-tyrosine is closer to home for us, so that's the one we concentrate on for people who have stimulant problems, cocaine, Ritalin, amphetamines, those kinds of drugs. And then there's probably the most important one is serotonin, because serotonin is involved in inflammation in the intestines, and so many people have intestinal problems. They lose all their serotonin to what's going on in their intestines, and they don't have any tryptophan left over to get to the brain to help them make this relaxing, calming neurotransmitter, serotonin. And so a lot of angry, irritable people with mood swings are walking around out there, and they don't know why they're like that. They just know that they have these problems, and it's because they just don't have enough serotonin. They don't have the amino acid tryptophan available. So there's an amino acid which is tryptophan's made into 5-hydroxytryptophan, or 5-HTP. 5-HTP is the direct precursor for serotonin, and it's much stronger. So 5-HTP is another very helpful amino acid for people who find themselves becoming dependent on SSRI-type medication like Prozac, Paxil, Effexor, where these drugs are just as addictive. All drugs are addictive. They're just as addictive as any drug. And when people find themselves hooked on these kinds of drugs and can't get off of them, 5-hydroxytryptophan can be very helpful. And then the fourth main one is GABA, G-A-B-A, and GABA is helpful for the sedative type of addictions. Valium, Ativan, Xanax, Klonopin, the sedative type of medications. And so GABA it can actually be taken directly, or you can take lots of glutamine with vitamin B6 and make your own GABA. And those four, GABA, GABA, 5-hydroxytryptophan, tyrosine, and D-phenylalanine, are the four main amino acid precursors for the four main kinds of imbalances that can happen.
I think that's all of them. Glutamine also, as you say, is very good for healing the gut, which is very nice too. And so when you've often got somebody who has multiple symptoms,
yes,
and
mm-hmm,
the glutamine is probably good. Also, I've noticed that if you mix glutamine and glycine, not lysine, but glycine, G-L-Y-C-I-N-E, those two together tend to boost glutathione levels, which are, mm-hmm, detox pathways. So those are also very helpful.
Yes.
And glutamine is useful for maintaining muscle mass, which prevents insulin resistance and stuff,
yes,
like that.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You can't go wrong with glutamine.
No, it's great stuff, and you can take quite a bit of it. All right, so let's move on to talking a bit about specific addictions. And the one I want to start with is the one that you are kind of unique in talking about. I've noticed none of the other people who write about the use of amino acids in treating addiction forget to talk about, and it's probably the hardest and most harmful addiction, which is smoking.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost, there actually isn't, I don't think there's anything a human being can do that's worse than smoke. And it's so ironic because all of us, I my parents were sort of medical people, and so of course when I was like 16 or something, I had to experiment with cigarettes just to make them completely out of their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And it was effective. It did age them amazingly. I did quit when I started noticing that I was getting addicted, which I thought was irritating. But people don't have any understanding of why cigarettes are so harmful, and I just as soon let you take it on unless your voice is cutting
sure.
out.
Well, the two main things, of course, most people know that there's a direct toxic effect of the smoke to the lungs, and there's a concern about chronic lung problems and cancer and heart disease. So there, I think that people pretty well are schooled in that. But, of course, the fear factor is not going to override an addiction once it's there, because an addiction is much more powerful than any amount of fear that can be brought to bear against it for most people. So it's the same kind of process. If you use nicotine, then you disrupt three main neurotransmitters in the brain. We mentioned two of them, which was serotonin and dopamine, which is made from tyrosine. But there's a third one, which is equally important, called acetylcholine, acetylcholine is made from lecithin that we get in eggs or soy, or you can actually take use lecithin on your cereal, or take lecithin capsules, and vitamin B5 or pantothene, which is made then into acetylcholine.
Acetylcholine is the smart chemical in fish.
Oh, is it really in fish?
Yeah.
Okay. It's definitely related to memory and the ability to maintain memory, and the Alzheimer's disease types of drugs artificially try to boost acetylcholine in the brain so that a person can maintain some of the memory that as this disease is progressing. But anyway, the same general process happens. If you use nicotine, your brain will adapt to the presence of the drug by making less of its natural nicotine. So the brain stops making acetylcholine, serotonin, and dopamine because the nicotine is there, so the brain has to adapt to the presence of the drug and simply makes less of the natural. So over time, if you try to stop using nicotine, now your brain doesn't have any of the natural nicotine, and a person experiences tremendous cravings to go back and use the drug again. And what we did in the book, and what is very simple to do, is to take enough choline, tyrosine, and 5-hydroxytryptophan, and just knock the cravings dead, flatten them right on the spot, and you still might have to fight through some of discomfort. There might be some left, but generally there is not very much there for most people. And what is very interesting is that cigarettes even taste bad when people use these nutrients, which we never expected. They have like a cardboard kind of a taste. So that helps to stop them, too.
it's interesting also there's two important issues here. One is that nicotine that we have a natural form of nicotine in acetylcholine is a little misleading, because nicotine is a poison. You point out in the book that if you take 2 to 3 drops of nicotine and put it on someone's skin, it will kill them.
Can't prevent it either.
So there's something about a nicotine patch here which seems counterintuitive.
Yeah. Well, the latest, they have these little snorters, these nicotine snorters.
Yeah.
That you sniff in the nose, and then they get the nicotine directly up through the brain, through the top of the nose.
Yeah, but might it be a good idea for people to not have nicotine in any form, even while they're withdrawing from the cigarettes?
Well, of course, and the idea of treating nicotine addiction with nicotine. I mean, nobody questions it. I mean, the most amazing thing is that you don't have people scratching their heads saying, this is nuts. This is crazy.
Well, there's been this sort of mythology that cigarette smoking is bad for you because you're inhaling smoke, which, yeah, I mean, you're not, you know, Indian, Native Americans did not hang their heads over the fire and inhale deeply all the time. I mean, they used it as a ceremonial thing. So inhaling smoke, I mean, that isn't what you're supposed to do. You don't see firefighters, you know, running into a fire and inhaling. That's not what we're supposed to do. But that isn't even really the biggest problem, because there are so many toxic metals and nicotine
right.
in cigarettes that are poisonous. I mean,
right.
severely poisonous to the heart
right.
and to the cardiovascular system.
And so lots of times people will use the protocol in the book, and they'll generally be able to cut down to about 20%. If they don't want to stop, they'll notice that they can't smoke more than 20% of what they were initially smoking. So if they're one pack a day smoker, they'll be down to 4 or 5 cigarettes a day. And then if they're going to stay with that, what I try to do is convert them over to the natural tobacco is available and that the Native Americans use. And it's not laced with all these chemicals and toxic metals.
Yeah, but it may be that people eventually can let it go anyway. But they may eventually just let it go if it's only 4 cigarettes a day.
Right.
The other thing here, and let me also say here that just 4 cigarettes a day, it's like, would you go and buy a loaf of bread if it said on it only contains 3% carcinogenic element? I mean, you wouldn't buy something knowing that it caused cancer. So would you smoke 4 cigarettes a day knowing, you know, it's kind of one of those things.
No, and if that innate compulsion driven by the neurotransmitter deficiency, if that's no longer there,
yes,
it becomes so much easier.
Easier.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to mention is the connection between serotonin and estrogen. Low estrogen also lowers serotonin. So if you've got a woman who's smoking and lowering her serotonin levels, and then she goes into menopause, it's not going to be pretty for her brain.
Right.
Alcohol and drugs in the young affect the frontal lobe, which is the last to develop. And this, I would think, causes a frontal lobe inhibition, which is pretty scary stuff. Frontal lobe inhibition, are we talking Tourette's here?
Well, in its most extreme form, you might get injury to that extent, or you might unmask a genetic potential for something
and
like
there's
that.
There's a lot of that.
But more, it has more to do if you use enough drugs long enough, you will actually get shrinkage of the frontal lobes irreversibly. But a lot of that can heal. When a person stops, of course, healing takes over and they get a lot of it back. But the frontal lobes govern a lot of things, but most notably what they're most known for is the ability to inhibit impulse. So if I might say I might impulsively want to go do something, but then
something violent.
Yes, or yeah. Something violent, right? I see somebody, I don't like them, I want to slug them. But the frontal lobes check in on that and say, well, okay, slug them, but you go to jail and you're going to do this, you're going to do this, you're going to do this, and you can see your whole difficult future laid out for you, so you inhibit that impulse based on the consequences of your actions. If you take out the frontal lobes, you don't have that. If a drug inhibits the frontal lobes, then the person loses their impulse control, and they just act on impulse and then get in trouble.
So it means that it's terribly important, especially in the young developing brain, to keep people away from, you know, to substitute nutrient density and nutrients for. Now we're really completely out of time, and I have to get people to help us run the station. But I wanted, just before we go, for you to tell us about the success rate of nutrient intervention.
Well, of course, it varies from person to person and for different conditions. But in general, as medical director at Tully Hill, we did an outcome study that confirmed 2 previous studies, which suggested that the long-term recovery rates, abstinence from drugs and alcohol, can be enhanced by a factor of 3 times. We can get 70 to 80% recovery rates at 1 and 2 years. Which is much, much higher than that can be attained with only a traditional treatment program. But this is adjunctive. This is something that's added on top of a traditional treatment program. It doesn't take the place of it. It doesn't take the place of AA
or therapy.
But what it does is allows whatever benefit a person is getting from AA or therapy to be enhanced dramatically.
Got it. Okay. And you're probably fixing a lot of other underlying causes, too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. We've got to let you go. Rest up and go spray your throat with some echinacea and propolis. And thank you so much for the work you do and putting up with everything you've had
to do. Thank you for the work you do, too. And thanks for having me on the show.
It was such a pleasure.
Okay.
Dr. Charles Gant, MD, PhD, his book, End Your Addiction Now. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, the Progressive Health Observer, and Radio on Demand, where you can download archives and articles, go to the website yourownhealthandfitness.org. If you need to reach Jeff Fawcett, he's at 707-874-1496. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA-FM. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.